We'd like to welcome everyone. We're going to convene a meeting of the Mesa Housing Authority Governing Board. And the first item on the agenda, I'd like to welcome Mr. Bill Egan, who is a member in addition to the Mesa City, members of the Mesa City Council.
Summers.
Who is also a member of the board. We'll begin with conducting a public hearing to discuss the 2009 Streamlined Annual Public Housing Authority Plan. Ms. Carolyn.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. If you would just want to open the public hearing, do the public hearing and ask.
Yes, we'll declare the public hearing opened.
Thank you.
That's right. Are there any comments from the council? Anyone wish to speak in the public hearing portion? We have one request to speak from Ms. Lucille Galimi, I think it is.
Yes.
Ms. Galimi? You'd like to sit there and have a seat?
I'm right here.
And you have 3 minutes. Thank you very much.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. My name is Lucille Galimi. I am part of the Mesa Housing Authority, and I am a member of the advisory board. We need affordable housing, and I thank you for supporting us for the City of Mesa Housing Authority.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Crocker, are there any other requests to speak from the public?
No additional requests.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak as part of the public hearing? Okay. There be no requests to speak. I declare the public hearing closed. I don't have a.
I was waiting,
Mr. Egan. I'm sorry.
I was waiting for Carolyn. I thought she was going to say something. I just wanted to say a few words, if I may. First of all,
go right ahead.
To you, I thank you for reappointing me again, and the council for unanimously okaying me. One of my neighbors said they probably made it unanimous because they probably had a background check on you and discovered, like the federal employees' appointments lately, that there's no tax problem, so they better take me. They may not have better luck next time.
Take what we can get, huh?
But seriously, this is my fifth year now that I've served on this group and serving on the advisory board, and I found that, once again, that they're doing a great job, and I hope that all of you will pass this unanimously to show your support for them. In your letter of appointment to me, you mentioned that people serve because they help build a better Mesa. I think this program has helped build a better Mesa in the 5 years that I've been exposed to it. It's grown, and they do a super job. They follow the federal dictates, of course. This is why we have these plans. But I'm so impressed with the personnel. And I live in a complex that has 700 units, and I don't know how many are on HUD, but probably a couple hundred. And I've never heard a complaint about the HUD program, and that's not normal. You know, normally, on any program, even against you people, I've heard some few complaints at times, but not serious ones, of course.
Oh, okay.
But, just talking to people, they'll say, oh, the city did this to me, or somebody did this to me. I've never heard them complain about HUD, and I know there's a vast number of people on the program, and it's spread out through all the council districts, which is good. Every one of you have some vouchers in your district. And so I'm just urging you to, once again, unanimously support the plan presented. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Egan. I'd like to thank you for your service. It truly is people like you who get involved, who give your time and your energy that does help build a better community. So thank you very much for your service. Ms. Olson.
Yes, each year we are required to submit a Public Housing Authority annual plan, and the one before you is the one that we propose to submit this year. And this, our funding is based upon submitting our plan and giving an idea of what we're going to be doing.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for? We have a motion to approve from Councilmember Cavanaugh.
Second.
Do we have a second from the Vice Mayor? Is there any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Ms. Olson.
Thank you.
Okay, if there's no other comments or questions, We have a motion to adjourn from Councilmember Summers, a second from the Vice Mayor. All in favor?
Aye.
The Housing Authority Governing Board meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much, Mr. Egan.
Vice Chair.
We'll now call to order the study session for the Mesa City Council for Thursday, April 9th, 2009. Councilmember Richens? Anyone? Must just be late.
Okay. I saw a fire truck going by.
First item on the agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. Mr. Villa.
Morning, Mayor and Council. Ray Villa, Neighborhood Services Director. With me, I have Ray Timmish, who's a Neighborhood Stabilization Program Coordinator for this project. We're here this morning just to give you an update on the Neighborhood Stabilization Program along with the fund allocation recommendations. As you remember from our previous presentations, this is federal funding that was allocated to the City of Mesa to acquire foreclosed and abandoned homes, to rehab, resell, redevelop, to create a more desirable neighborhood, and to stem the decline of homes in the 85204 area. Mesa's allocation was a little over $9.6 million for the program. And these are the uses for the funds as they were established by HUD. And some of the uses were establishing a financing mechanism for the purchase and redevelopment of these foreclosed homes, for the purchase and rehab of abandoned and foreclosed homes, also for the establishment of land banks for homes that have been foreclosed upon, the demolition of blighted structures, and the redevelopment of demolished and vacant properties. And this is the map of the 85204 area that we're proposing to work in. We have broken the area into six separate quadrants. And the reason why we did it this way is to kind of share with the council some of the impact that we have and the impact that some of the foreclosures have had in this area. Additionally, we have taken into consideration several other things that are in the area, which including government agencies, nonprofit agencies, and other services within the schools within that area. And what we've done is we've decided to focus on two sections, Section 1 and Section 2 of the area, which encompasses Main Street to 8th Avenue from Mesa Drive to Gilbert Road. And the reason why we did that is because we felt that that was the area that we had the highest concentration of foreclosures. We had the highest number of code violations in the area. Also had the highest crime statistics that were occurring in that area. And we also had several nonprofit and government agencies that were providing support for families in that area. And we felt that this program would be an added benefit to that support that already exists within that community. Additionally, we contacted the schools and found out that there are several programs that are being offered in the school, and we just kind of shared one of them here, which is the free lunch program, which as you can see that several of the schools, all of them mainly have around 95% of the students receiving some kind of free lunch program, which is a great help to that community. And this is just a breakdown of some of the services that are available in their area, which include DES, Child Administration, also Maricopa County, Workforce Development, and some of the other nonprofit agencies and services like Mesa CAN, Care Partnership, and Community Bridges that exist already in the area. And these are just a kind of a look at some of the houses that are in that area. So just to kind of give you a picture of them. And as you can see, most of them are pretty decent shape. And one of the things that we're going to be focused on really heavy with this program is really trying to target homes that are made out of block. The big reason why is because those are the ones that are going to be easier to rehab. They're also going to be easier for sustainability, especially with energy conservation and so forth, which we're planning on doing heavy with this program to, you know, make them green buildings as much as possible. wherever we can by, you know, putting several efficiencies to these homes so it'll be easier for the people who purchase them to go ahead and manage and handle them so they don't have any long-term effect with the properties. And again, some additional pictures. And these are some of the submittals that we received when we sent out an RFP earlier, at the end of last year. And these are the groups that submitted proposals to the program. As part of the program, we're going to be working with about half of these agencies in the process. Most of them, the half that we're working with, are meeting the ultimate goal of the program, which is mainly home ownership. And we felt that most of these can provide, the three that we chose to work with are have a great deal in that area. Also, they have some more permanent rental housing available through them. And we stayed away from the transitional housing, which was offered by some of the other nonprofit agencies. And this is a breakdown of the allocations. And again, we are planning on, the City of Mesa is planning on purchasing and rehabbing 13 to 18 single-family homes to target the area medium income between 51 to 120%. And what you'll see at the bottom of that slide is a breakdown of what the area medium income would be by family members, and just to kind of give you an indicator of what would be available to those folks that fit in those categories. Our plan is for to purchase, to rehab, and to resell these homes to qualified members. We're going to be working with not only realtors, but we're also going to be working with nonprofit organizations to get qualified people into these homes. So our, again, is we want long-term sustainable ownership in these areas, not just somebody that comes in, purchases homes, and you know, works it as an investment or anything like that. We don't want any of that in this area because we want long-term sustainability. We're also going to be giving Housing Our Communities $2.2 million for them to work in this area also to purchase and rehab 10 to 15 homes in that area. And we've contacted them, and we're working out that process, and we'll be getting going with them. Additionally, we'll be working with purchasing additional fourplexes and complexes to deal with the 50% or lower medium income in the area. And we'll be working with two organizations, the Mark Center and Save the Family, to try to see what, you know, what would fit their needs, also meet the needs of the area itself by purchasing these at these locations. And then we also put in a component there for demo, and we kind of put in a number of $1.1 million to demo properties. And one of the issues that we're going to try to do, if we see a property that's demo quality, our plan is to demo that property and then work with maybe something like Housing Our Communities or Habitat for Humanity to come in and build a home on that lot and to do something so they could sell that property back and get somebody qualified in the area.
So great. So what you're saying is that you say five homes. If you would it be possible that you'd buy more houses to demo, and then if you could get a Habitat for Humanity or someone to come in and build on that, that you would, is it possible to buy and demo the house, leave the blank lot, and then have another agency come in and build a house on there to sell or to find a permanent resident?
Yes, Mayor, if I could explain, under the program, we are allowed to demo the property there. We can, if it's a foreclosed property, we can purchase it and demo it. But if it's not a foreclosed property, we can't purchase it. Or if it's not been abandoned, we can't purchase it. But we still can demo the property as long as the person meets income level requirements. Another nonprofit could come along, like Habitat for Humanity or Housing Our Communities, could purchase that lot. We are allowed to provide funds for the redevelopment of that lot, meaning we can post funds for the building materials and whatever it costs to build a new structure there, as long as there are families that meet the income level requirements.
Yeah, I mean, because that interests me, because especially if you get someone like that, like Habitat for Humanity, where labor is donated, it seems like you can stretch and get a lot more.
Yes.
A lot more units and a lot more for the buck than you can if you go in and we treat it as a normal construction project, which I'm just not convinced we're going to get as many units as we possibly can. And I'm really interested in stretching, when, as getting as many units into this process as we possibly can, which means we've got to get the per unit cost down however we can. Yeah. I think in this case, quantity is a driving factor, and not that we give up quality, but I think if we can get two or three more houses out of this, then we're reaching the full potential of it, rather than having two or three houses that take to the maximum cost and the maximum effort. Council, okay, all right.
And just to mention, what Ray's been doing is he's been working with the mortgage companies, and we've been working out deals to try to get a discount by purchasing in bulk. And several of the mortgage companies have really indicated that they'd be willing to work with us, and actually have set up programs to deal with the NSP program. And so we're kind of excited, because we think we're going to try to stretch it as much as we can. The other thing I want to mention here is this is what we're allocating. If along the way we feel that we can, we need to change or amend this plan to get more bang out of it, we will definitely do that to try to change it. But this is just our recommendation for right now as we get started with the program. And finally, Housing Our Community will be getting $500,000 to assist with down payment assistance. And finally, they will also get funding to do some approved housing counseling for the program.
And Councilman Richens has a question.
Tell me how admin fund works for this program, because there's a lot of work in here that's outside of our usual CDBG program and other funding mechanisms that fund your department. How does the admin work or get embedded in here?
It's 10% of the total project. And I will tell you that we're allocated to use 10% for the project while the project is ongoing. And
okay, so break that down by a category. So like that first line you have up there, the 2.8
right.
million. So embedded in there is 280,000 for admin for those
right.
those 13 prod
right.
13 to 18 projects.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Vice Mayor
Ray, I want to go back to the subject of the purchase, demo, and building of homes.
Mm-hmm.
Purchasing a foreclosed property that needs to be demoed, great deal. I'm not convinced that the city is really going to be a builder. And what the mayor had said, and the response we got back didn't really fit what I thought the mayor was saying, is can we just purchase and demo some foreclosed, really homes that need to be gone, and let Habitat or some others rebuild those homes?
Yes,
we can.
Yes.
So I would rather see that, instead of saying purchase, demo, and build five homes, make sure that spells out that Mesa is not going to be the builder, because we are not the most economical way to build.
No, and we understand that, and that's not our plan. And we only put this number in there because we had to have some kind of number to submit to HUD,
right.
And so that's how we put it in there. But we're hoping to, what the mayor recommended here is to try to stretch it out as much as we can. We may be able to purchase 10 homes, 10 lots with this amount of money, or 15 lots, and then be able to hand them over for somebody else to build on them. And that's kind of what we're
looking for. Well, I would prefer to see it spelled out that way as we present to HUD.
Yeah, and I think where we're getting, and what I'm hearing from others is that I understand when you say, yes, we can. There's a lot of cans and mays in there. And I understand that everything's not fixed because you got to go out there and see what the individual houses are, what's truly available, what you can do. But I think what I'm hearing, what I would like to see is rather than a can in May, that's what our direction is going to be. That, you know, we are not going into this with the idea we're going to build homes. There are many other people who can do it much more economically and much better than the city can do. And I don't know how we word that or what kind of assurance you get. And that's what I think I'm hearing, is that I don't know if the city wants to be in home. This council wants to be in the home building business, but we want to facilitate others who are in the home building business and can do it, especially in this economy, in a much more economical manner than we can.
Well, I will guarantee you that we will not do that.
Okay. Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. Ray, several months ago, I participated in a program where you had a manufactured home that was placed on a site after you demoed it and replaced it. Is that also the sort of option that you might look at, depending on the neighborhood and the lot, for this program, or is that still going to continue to be a separate program that you look at for other areas of the city?
That would be a separate program through our CDBG, and you know, CDBG program. And the reason why is those kind of structures would not really fit for this particular neighborhood, so we wouldn't want to go in that direction.
Okay. Councilmember Higgins?
My understanding, I might have been all out to lunch, but I did not think that we were going to be actually the purchasers to this size of money, this like $3 million. I really thought that everything that was going on was going to be done by a nonprofit, and we were going to funnel the money from the government through to them. So I'm surprised to see that we're actually going to be doing purchasing and buying. I really thought this was all going to be done by other nonprofits in the community. So I'm disappointed to see the word City of Mesa on any line item at all in this chart. Thank you.
The reason why we're doing that is two reasons. One is because of the time crunch that we have to do the program. It's about a an 18-month period that we have to go ahead and allocate and spend this funding. And we felt that we could do this, and it was really targeted for government agencies, but you know, we have limited agencies out there that have the capacity to do this kind of work and really do it effectively. We found Housing for Mesa to be probably the most effective group out there to do this, and they had the capacity to. And by the way, Housing Our Communities is not only getting funding from us, but they're also getting funding from several other cities. And they've already mentioned to us that it's going to be a really hard stretch to do some of the work. So in order for us to assure that this gets spent and gets allocated in the right area, we felt that it was important for us to take part of the money and make sure that the goals of the program are really met and that we can do that. Again, there's no plan here for us to hold on to these homes, to have any kind of ownership. We're just purchasing them, rehabbing them, and getting rid of them. And we're going to continue to work with the nonprofit organizations to help us accomplish that.
Okay.
And finally, I just want to share the timeline. And again, we had our contract executed by HUD back on the 19th. We returned the contract to them back on March 30th. So just to let you know, the clock started on March 19th, so we're kind of excited to get going. And then our deadline for making sure that this money gets allocated is in September 18th, 2010. So in other words, all that money has to be allocated by that date. And then we have up to 2013 to make sure that the program, whatever we need to complete, that the program ends at that date, and that's the time, the completion of this overall program.
When you say allocated, does that mean well-defined, committed?
Yes, and committed.
There's no changes after that?
Right.
And then you have that, whatever that time period is, to actually carry out that thing which you've committed to?
Correct.
Okay. All right, Councilmember Finter.
Just a quick question. Going back, you mentioned two fine organizations with regard to the fourplexes and multifamily housing, Mark Center and Save the Family. I believe was the two that we're looking at. Is it our position that what will happen is Mark Center will and Save the Family would retain ownership in the long term for those? So that wouldn't be something that they would take, fix up, manage, and then sell or move on to another entity. They would retain those.
That's correct. We would essentially purchase property, rehab it for them, and then turn it over to them with some type of deed restriction or lien on a property that basically says they need to operate it for this period of time and serve the income levels that we're targeting as well, at which time we would do a transfer of ownership basically with a deed restriction or some type of lien in that situation. We don't want to own the property,
right.
Similar to what we do now with the lease agreements that we have. But in this situation, we're going to try to do something a little different where we'd actually transfer the title over to it. Reason we're doing a purchase and a rehab for them, there's this issue of program income. When we give them the money to purchase and rehab, now we have a program income issue that has to be monitored for a very long time, for the length of the building or the life of the building. By us purchasing, rehabbing, and doing some type of transfer of sale, or I should say transfer of title, it's considered a sale of the property. That way, the program income does not become a factor anymore. It's not something that has to be monitored for a very long time.
Well, what's important for me is two great organizations, stable, well, a good history. So I'd like to make sure that stays with those organizations and isn't produced and then passed on to somewhere else that we wouldn't quite understand or know the. So that would be my goal.
And that's where we put the lien restriction, or the deed restriction, basically saying they need to operate it for this period of time and target those families. And if they're not operating, then we have some right to take back the property and find another nonprofit that can manage it.
Thank you, Mayor.
Councilman Richens.
Hey, John Smith, are you back there somewhere? You mind coming up here for a minute, ask you a couple questions? How you doing, buddy? You awake?
Anytime you talk
why don't you introduce your guest to everybody?
John Smith is the executive director of Housing Our Communities.
Yes.
It's one of the agencies here in line. We talked a little bit about capacity of your organization and City of Mesa doing some stuff and you doing some stuff. Tell me about where you're at with your capacity of your organization. Can you handle the amount of projects we're giving you? Can you handle more? What's happening out there?
We've limited our participation in the NSP program across Phoenix Metro because our goal is to serve the city which has funded us for 21 years, which is the City of Mesa. So our NSP participation is only in one other community, the City of Avondale, which is a very small award, and we've been doing a program for them for a couple years. So our focus is the City of Mesa simply because that's our home. And our capacity is to do as much as the City of Mesa wants us to do. I mean, last year we produced 198 homeowners, first-time homeowners. We believe we have that capacity. If the city believes that in its efforts, it turns some more of that over to us, we believe we can handle that. We have the staff. And I believe our track record speaks for itself. That
if
we
you
can
had
do that.
13 to 18 projects, if we had another 10 to 15 projects to that number, could you
those are
that?
Homes no I well, you call them projects, I call them homes. And and the biggest challenge in working with the staff is finding that qualified home buyer. That's the key. It's not just the unit, even though this money is unique in that it focuses on foreclosed properties, not necessarily the family, say as the home program does. We believe there's got to be a marriage of those two or it's not going to work. Our job is long-term sustainability for the community of Mesa. We've lost four houses in 21 years to foreclosure. Something we're doing is right. And so we want to continue doing what's right and do more of it for the city.
Yeah, I think your track record was, what, one or two before this current?
Our last foreclosure was 1997.
97, okay.
Yeah.
Great, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
All righty. Thank you. Next item on the agenda is to hear present. Oh, by the way, I think the direction that came out in that discussion was pretty clear. Move forward based on that. Okay.
With the stipulation that we don't want to do that. Sure,
yeah, with restating that we don't want to be in the home building business.
Correct.
So I think that's pretty clear. Okay, next item on the agenda is item two. Hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on budget-related issues. First one we'll hear from is the Energy Resources Department. Yes, and
where are you?
Councilmember Summers wants to know where the food is.
We're going to provide the burritos after we actually get the computer presentation.
Rather than a carrot on a stick, that's sort of a burrito on a stick.
Yes. Yeah. It's an orange stick painted orange.
Okay. Frank.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Frank McRae. I'm the Energy Resources Department Director. And with me today on your right is Michael Comstock, who's our Deputy Director.
Good morning.
And on your left to me is Melissa Jones, who's our Enterprise Services Coordinator, Manager, Super Lady. We've been in the natural gas and electric business in the City of Mesa for about 97 years now. We celebrated our 95th anniversary in 2007, and it was quite an event. I know some of you may have been able to attend that meeting. One of the things I just wanted to point out from the outset is we're focused on safe, reliable, and affordable, cost-effective natural gas and electric utility services. And all of the things that we do now, our mission statements, our performance measures, are focused and directed towards that goal. Beginning in the first quarter of 2008, we began assembling out of five distinct entities within the Utilities Department, the Energy Resources Department. So our department now is a combination and an integration of the Electric Distribution Division, the Gas Distribution Division, the Resources Division, a share of what was formerly called Utility Services, which provided both field services to water, wastewater, and gas, particularly in terms of emergency first response, and then a share of what had become the administrative section over time. What we do is we are focused on the planning and acquisition of energy resources, electric generation supplies, natural gas supplies, finding ways to transmit those resources from their source to the City of Mesa's distribution system, making sure that we distribute those energy supplies to our customers reliably, safely, and then making sure that we're prudently and efficiently managed from both a financial perspective as well as an operational perspective. Upon the integration of the teams, we found some immediate benefits from reorganizing and reintegration of our activities, and you can see many of those mergers there. What we found is that there was certain work groups within our organizations that were very, very efficient, were on the best practices path, and there were deficiencies in those same areas and other areas. So we've been able to share personnel and resources and expertise and knowledge in certain areas, and we've really enhanced our operations amongst all of our programs. We also implemented we've also implemented a strategic planning process, and our first step in that was last year when we began a strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats assessment. And so we've completed that process. We've had several initiatives come out of that. And most recently, the ones that we're pursuing is the assessment of opportunities in the economic stimulus package. There's a number of cities that are in the electric utility business, but there's also a number of cities that are served by investor-owned utilities. Mesa is not really unique in the fact that it has an electric utility. There's three primary reasons for cities to be in the electric utility business. One is to provide an enhanced level of customer service. We think we do that. We have very short response times to any type of emergencies, any type of outages. Like to have, and we like to promote, that we have very comparable, if not advantageous, rates and bills. And we've made significant progress over the last several years in getting our rates to be a comparable level with SRP. A couple of years ago, when we first implemented our energy cost recovery mechanism, our rates were about 20 to 25% higher than SRP's. Now we're down within 3% of SRP's. And in fact, for the month of February, for an average residential customer, we're actually about a dollar less than SRP's. So over the course of the year, that will change because of different rate structures between ourselves and SRP, but we've made substantial progress in getting to a parity. Let me go to the ELMO to kind of illustrate what part of the system, the electrical network that Mesa owns and operates. Well, until we get that shown, what I would indicate to you is that typically electric utilities and natural gas utilities are fairly vertically integrated. If you look at SRP system, they're much more vertically integrated than ourselves. They own at least a piece of all of the different components of the electrical transmission network, from the generator stations to the transmission lines and substations, all the way down to the customer's meter. Whereas the City of Mesa, we contract for all of the generation portion of providing service, all the way down to that transmission substation. And then that's where we begin ownership of our facilities up to the customer's meter. And so because we don't own all of these pieces, we would consider ourselves quite a bit less vertically integrated than a utility like SRP. Our energy supply costs, when you look at our rates versus some other utilities' rates, they may seem high. Our energy supply costs account to about 70% of our total costs of service. Well, one of the reasons, if you compare that with SRP, is SRP has used long-term debt financing to fund their construction of generation plants and transmission lines, whereas we're paying for that on a monthly basis through energy supply contracts. If we could go to our service area map, we primarily serve districts 1 and 4 with small pieces of districts 2 and 3. And you can see our statistics on our PowerPoint. We serve about 16,000 customers. It amounts to about 5.5 square miles in the downtown area. And currently we have 14 substations, and I'll get into a little bit more detail later about how we're converting our distribution system from 4,000 volts to 12,000 volts. One of the significant benefits in doing that conversion is it will allow us to convert from 14 substations to 4 substations, and we'll still be able to maintain reliability. We'll actually improve our efficiencies, and we'll be able to provide better service. We've had some recent significant accomplishments. As I talked about the conversion, we are probably getting close to about 15% of the conversion. This has been a very long-term project. We started converting some of our 4 kV circuits to 12 kV circuits about 20 years ago. And because of different financial constraints that we faced, we have deferred, delayed, downsized the conversion program. But over the course of the last couple of years, we've become focused on that. We've been fortunate to get management's support and the funding and using of different financial funds to perform that conversion, and we're making great progress now through the use of consultants and contractors to help us perform that conversion. We've returned our focus again on the safety and reliability of the system. We've done a distribution pole assessment to assess the condition of our poles, determine which poles and the attachments to those poles need to be replaced. We've gone through a significant pole replacement. One of our major projects recently has been along University between Lewis and Stapley. You've probably seen some traffic barricades. We've replaced wooden poles that had deteriorated over time to the extent that we were bracing them. We have replaced those with concrete poles. And in intermittent areas, we've put in steel poles so that if a monsoon storm comes along, we should be able to withstand much higher winds than we historically have experienced without having a failure of those poles. So a dramatic improvement in both safety and reliability. We also did a very thorough assessment of our underground vault lids. Vault lids go through a lot of abuse over time with vehicles and trucks passing over them. They're exposed to a lot of mechanical forces. And so we've gone through a thorough assessment of our vault lids, and we're in a process of replacing those. We reestablished tree trimming. For several years, we cut back on tree trimming for budgetary purposes. We've reestablished that tree trimming program. It's going to make a significant difference when monsoon winds come and the amount of those small momentary outages. By reducing that vegetation growth on our lines and our poles, we've substantially improved our safety and our reliability. One of our historical challenges that we've been dealing with was the purchase of some internal combustion generator sets back in the early 2000s. They were essentially a very expensive insurance policy that we really never had to draw a claim upon. So last year we started looking to sell those units. We ultimately ended up in a sale contract after a competitive sale process. Empire bought those units and they were removed completely in February. And so now we have that real estate available to us to enhance our storage facilities, the security of storage, and perhaps some growth at those substations where those plants were located. We've also, in working with the Water Resources Department and building safety and sustainability, have been able to install 2 test concentrated solar photovoltaic arrays out at the CAP water treatment plant. We've been kind of on a research demonstration basis, and we have a contract to install two more arrays. We've already got the pedestal built for one. It's in a part of the CAP plant that is up adjacent to the external wall, and so it's pretty much an ideal location for arrays of this nature. It's a nice buffer between an industrial facility like a water treatment plant and a recreational area. The energy from these arrays goes back into SRP's system at the point of delivery of service to the ball field lights at Mesa Red Mountain Park. For our financial review for fiscal year 08-09, we've been very, very close on our revenues, right at about $36.2 million, the variance being less than $50,000. Excuse me. The variance is small, but we've had some factors that contribute to that are fairly significant to mention. Our residential revenue is down about $1.2 million from our forecast amount. We've had a substantial loss of residential customers because of the economy and some other possible issues that we can attribute it to. Our interest on investment, as you've heard before from the Water Resources Department, is down. For us, it's down about $400,000 on the electric side. Those losses, if you will, are offset by a one-time settlement from a group that we participate in to pool resources together and buy and sell energy. And we had a $600,000 settlement from them in 08-09. And then we had the proceeds from the sale of the generator sets of about $1 million. So that offsets, all of those factors offset each other so that we're within about $50,000 of our budgeted revenues. On the expenditure side, we're about $3.5 million less than budgeted. That's primarily due to some reduced consumption on our customers' part, which allows us to reduce the purchases that we make. And then we also had a replacement of a previous supply contract where we're able to get a much more advantageous price on the replacement contract than what we had initially forecasted.
Vice Mayor has a question.
Frank, where are we at on the contracts time-wise? You know, you have a specified time and then you have to renew. Where are we at in our contracts for electric and gas and so forth?
We have on the electric side, we have a portfolio of resources. Our total resource needs are about 95 megawatts to meet our summertime peak. We have under long-term firm contracts about 80 megawatts. The contract that expired in December of last year was replaced with a three-year agreement starting in February. We were lucky to get the prices in that contract were about 30% less than what we had originally projected in the prior planning documents that you saw last year. So that's a three-year contract. Thank you. That will expire before the peak of 2012, and so we will be issuing competitive solicitations, looking at other alternatives to replace that expiring contract as well as other contracts. That's a 15 megawatt contract. So it is a substantial piece of our resource portfolio, and but we do have a planning process in place that identifies those needs and projects and gives us the time frames that we need to be able to pursue those resources. So in addition to the competitive solicitations, we're also looking at participation in generation projects that are being jointly developed by many utilities such as Arizona Electric Power Cooperative, Salt River Project, et cetera. Our financial results for 08-09 are looking very, very strong. We had a total net income budgeted of $6.3 million. Our forecast for the completion by the end of fiscal year 08-09 is $9.8 million. We had a budgeted general fund transfer of $6.3 million. We'll be able to easily make that transfer. It'll leave us an ending fund balance of about $9.9 million, so we'll be in very healthy condition by the end of the fiscal year.
Frank, Councilmember Kavanaugh has a question.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. And it's a question related to the fund balances. I also see that you're forecasting down a little later in the presentation a fund balance of about 12.2 and having a transfer of like 6. I'm wondering what is the point where you feel you need a fund balance that is sufficient for safety purposes or risk purposes? And the reason I'm asking this is that, for example, in human services area, we're probably going to be seeing a projection of reductions in the money that we make available to community organizations for human services, including things like utility assistance and things like that. And, you know, I'm wondering is whether there is some play in that fund balance transfer that might afford us some additional funds, at least to maintain our human services funding at the same rate as we were before, or would there be unintended consequences for doing something like that I'm not aware of?
I would like to defer to our budget and research people for the long-term financial thresholds that we'd be looking at in terms of ratios. But I can tell you that you know, we're very sensitive to that. We feel like a large part of our role in being in the electric utility industry that's owned by a city is to provide financial support, be a part of that formula. We have increased the projected general fund transfer. If you look at the prior forecast from last year at this time, our projected transfer out was about $2 million by the end of the planning horizon. So we've increased that by about $4 million to the $6 million level now.
And certainly, from my perspective, increasing the fund balance is also important because I served on the Finance in the Future Committee, and one of the important concerns that we had on that committee and recommendations to the City Council was to work on increasing the utility fund balances so that we had adequate funds for repair and replacement. And so I'm fully supportive of that. I'm just wondering what's the point where we have where we move out of a zone of comfort.
Well, I think what you're going to see, we're going to come back and give you a complete rundown of all the utilities when we talk about the utility rates, and we'll give you the models that show some of these things. What we've done from a large accomplishment this year is breaking all the utilities into independent operating units. So what you're seeing is some of the fluctuations on those units where we'll be making some purchase and debt buys on things like electric. We have to go back and reassess then what we're going to do in cash versus debt, and that will drive some of the fund balance decisions. What we have done from an overall philosophy is frozen that transfer from the enterprise to the general fund, just maintaining with the long-term goal of sufficient fund balance in right now in the targets of 14-15. So we're looking at very comprehensively. So we do have some decisions to make in the future, but probably put it in the discussion of that greater model when we come back and talk to you about rates, if you so choose.
Yeah, Mayor, Councilman Kavanaugh, what the way to look at that is, we've tried to establish fund balances that get in our 8-10% range for all the funds over the forecasted period. And sometimes they may be higher on the front end because we're anticipating large capital purchases or whatever it might be during that period of time. So if the council is interested in providing additional funding somewhere, you know, for other purposes in the general fund, I think for the model that we set up, what we'd ask is, tell us what, you know, let's decide what the amount might be. I mean, it could be used for human services, it could be used for transit, whatever. And then allow us, if you could, to then use that across the board of the utility so that they always have a kind of a consistent allocation of that transfer as opposed to going to just one of the enterprises, because then that kind of creates a inconsistent application of that transfer. And it's available. We can do it. I would just say give us the amount, and then what we would do is then allocate it across all of the utilities. That would be one approach in order to increase the total transfer to cover some of those needs.
If I could just add also, one of the public policy issues that we have is our electric utility area serves about 40,000 citizens. It's about 16,000 customers. So, you know, from my perspective, we have an inordinately small number of citizens providing an inordinately large amount of financial support to the city, but we're proud to do that. But I think that needs to be accounted for, as well as while we are on a parity basis, very close with SRP on our residential customers, we have a fairly significant difference still to manage on our commercial customers. A large part of our commercial customers is our city facilities, and so there may be a way of moderating our rates to the city facilities, which would moderate the amount of general fund transfer that we would need to be made. And so it's kind of like an internal transfer payment in terms of we charge our buildings electric rates that then go to the electric utility, then gets in the form of a general fund transfer back to the general fund. So we want to do a rate study starting later this year so that we can take a real close look, strategic look at that, and come back and say, here's some solutions to these utility problems or utility challenges, as well as the other challenges that cities have that own utilities.
Right, and there's another part of another method to my madness in that if we look, for example, at human services funding, I would suspect that there is an inordinately large share of the human services funding that is coterminous with the boundaries of our electric utility district. And so that's another reason I'm looking at for, you know, those people are paying the those utilities, but also, you know, we're coming back in and providing services to them. So that's just another, at least a philosophical reason on my part that you might look at it, you know, from a community-wide perspective in terms of where do we allocate our funds. And so that, Mayor, that's simply one aspect of that.
Well,
you know,
as part of that discussion also, and I appreciate coming back later with rates where we're going to get into details, but we've got a lot into the details right now. And I think we need to spell out what our priorities are, because there are a lot of moving parts that just got discussed in the last 5 minutes. And you're talking rates, you're talking about service area, you're talking about general fund transfers, you're talking about reserves, you're talking about all these things, and they're all interrelated, but they all have to be based on priorities and policies. And I think you mentioned a few things that maybe if I could summarize where I believe this council would like to look at as we address the issues that Councilmember Kavanaugh's brought up, because they are all interrelated, not only with this utility, but as all the different utilities interact, because it's the same issue across the board. And that is, number one, electric's a little different simply because, as Frank said, we have a small area and a relatively small minority of citizens who in the past, through rate differentials and varying general fund contributions to the general fund, have been asked to bear a disproportionate burden. What I think policies that have been made in the past couple, 3 years, and I think what this council would like to continue is that these equalize. That if someone living on this side of the street who is served by the city of Mesa isn't paying disproportionate amount for their electricity than someone across the street who is served by SRP. And one of the ways to start with that is to freeze the amount each year that the city as a whole is looking to the electrical utility as part of the general fund, which I believe the freezing of the amount of transfer, and most people don't understand this transfer. That's a nice little term we use, but basically is how much do our electrical customers contribute to the overall operations of the city? And what we've said is that we're going to freeze that. Now that amount is frozen at a level that I hope is determined based on the overall objective, which is to equalize rates so that we don't have these disparities where one of our citizens is paying a disproportionate amount to electricity than their neighbor who happens to be served by SRP. And I think that's where what I'm hearing is that's where we start. We want rate parity as much as we can. And I know there's a lot of different things that play into that, you know, fuel adjusters and all that kind of stuff that you can't sit there and say, but we're parity, so that everyone comparing bills, they don't feel like they're being asked to bear some burden that they believe is unfair. I mean, would that be accurate?
That is accurate.
Okay. Then the next thing is that we're going to determine on a fixed basis how much of that would go normally in normal operations to the general fund. Now, I don't know which is the driver, whether the fund balance is the driver, the reserve is the driver, or whether the transfer is the driver.
It's a balancing act.
Yeah, okay. And that's what I meant. What we do is we look at this reserve, and there's two things that go into the reserve, as I understand it, right? Number one is what kind of reserve do we need to maintain financial security, stability, I would say. And that goes into bonding issues and rating and just smart management, which is to maintain that security level. The other thing would be our capital program. Because for years and years, our electrical utility has operated on a cash basis. We have not, we do not have a large level of debt related to other electrical utilities that are very capital intensive. And for example, you mentioned SRP and some of the differences. I don't know what the numbers are. My guess is if you compared five utilities as far as their debt level based on their capital, our electrical utility would be very much at the bottom as far as the amount of debt they have.
That's true.
For the assets, which means our assets have been paid for through rates, through cash.
Current cash.
So that reserve balance is also going to be determined based on the balancing between the safety level, and these are decisions about how much we want to finance by debt, how much we want to finance by cash.
Right.
So as we get into this, these detailed rate discussions, I think it might be important to start with the priority and say, here's where we are in rates, and here's and it seems like everything will flow from that, because we can defer, not all, but some capital programs. I mean, we've deferred the conversion from 4 kV to 12 for 20 years, did you say we've been working on it? I mean, you could make a real argument that that was the smartest thing to do or that was not a smart thing to do, but that's what it is. We've put that over many, many years, which has created other issues as far as maintenance and outages and operational costs, because as you're operating, what'd you say, 12 substations?
14.
Versus we're going to get down to 4. I mean, it would just seem like you could operate a lot more economically for substations that are not having the blowouts and the other things that we've had due to old equipment and just incompatibility with systems that we'll have with that we currently have with 14. So we need to make some big decisions as far as going forward, how aggressive we want to be on the capital improvement, how much, and that goes right into this fund balance deal. So if when we come back for rates, and I've probably just confused the heck out of the issue more so than ever, but I would like the conversation not to start with fund balance, this. Can we start with the priorities and say, here's our rates, here's our goal, which is to equalize as best as we can rates so that there's a perception and a reality of fairness across the board. And then how does that filter down as it relates to what we're going to contribute to our general fund and how that's going to factor in with our capital program? If we can take that approach when we get into the detailed discussions of rates, I'd appreciate it.
I think you did an excellent job of summarizing what we've tried to accomplish. We use that fund balance then just to measure how well we're doing against your priorities. And what we're seeing now, I want to remind everybody, fund balance is just a point in time. So now when we change a philosophy, you may have points in time that reflect a higher fund balance just because we've got a point in time we're measuring something, a change in philosophy of cash versus debt. And those kind of things.
Well,
you've got to balance all those.
I think what's important for us, who I guess in a sense operate as the board of directors to an electrical utility, is that we need to decide on a policy, on a business policy, if we do have, and I don't want to call it excess, because in reality there is no such thing as excess cash. Everything is spoken for based on a certain set of priorities. I mean, if we have a huge amount of cash, well, we have more than enough capital projects just in the 4 kV conversion, which many would argue is past due, and just in making up for normal operations, we have plenty of demands on that cash. So as a board, we need to set a policy that says, listen, we're basically, if we take things and put them more into the general fund or put them to other items, we have to choose between deferring a capital project or having a skinnier reserve so that we put ourselves more at financial risk. But that's a policy decision. And I'd like to make that in as simple as context as we can, because that's really what we're doing, in my understanding. Is that correct?
I think you've done a very good job summarizing what we're trying
to do. What we say is we anticipate that we're going to continue to be profitable. I hope we're profitable. If we're losing money in our electrical, then that's not a good thing. And that profit will both help us with our city operations, our service, but also take care of our financial stability and our capital programs. If you could lay it out as simple as possible, what those choices you believe we're making as we're starting down the road, understanding that from a rate standpoint, I would not feel comfortable if we came in with a rate that was anything different than stable or nearly as comparable to SRP as possible. I just don't want to go there. I don't know how others feel, but that should be a start. And I understand that's a moving target. And I understand that that's difficult to define and to quantify, but at least from conceptually. Okay. Sorry about that.
Fine.
I just wanted to get Frank, out, because I was getting confused. Either.
We're going to need to pick it up.
Yes,
we've got other things to do. So,
Our capital improvement program for 08-09 is going to amount to about $6.8 million. About $800,000 of that was projects that were carried over from 07-08. We are on schedule to complete those $6.8 million. We've done a lot of work. We've been focusing on and working very closely with our engineering office and with some great contractors and great consultants to achieve that $6.8 million. We've talked a lot about the components of the CIP already. A couple of additions there we haven't previously talked about was the security wall at the Robeson substation. You'll be seeing a contract in front of you on the 20th of April for that substation wall. We've had some very severe security breaches at the Robeson substation. It is a substation where we store substantial amounts of equipment. It's currently protected by a chain link fence that is easy to traverse, and we've had a lot of theft of very expensive materials out of that substation. So this wall is very critical to making that substation more safe. And we've also had a number of service extensions, expansions to new and expanding customers from municipal facilities to Chester's, Harley-Davidson, et cetera. Our budget for 09-10 is very close and substantially unchanged from 08-09. The major variances are due to the reduced build consumption from our customers' consumption. Loss of customers were about 800 customers less than we were in 2005, and our ECAP revenues will be adjusted to reflect that. ECAP is our energy cost adjustment factor, so that as our energy supply costs go up, the goal is to have a dollar-for-dollar increase in our energy supply rates, and as costs go down, we also have a dollar-for-dollar decline. These are the major components for our 09-10 budget. Our personal services remains about the same. We've talked a lot about the CIP. We intend to take about $3 million out of what had been previously forecasted to be funded with proceeds from bond sales. We are going to pay about $3 million of that out of cash, and our commodities for our energy supply cost will be about $18.2 million. We are projecting no general rate increases for the 09-10. Again, that's not including the energy cost adjustment factor. There are some anticipated adjustments there, but no general rate increases are anticipated through fiscal year 14-15. That should allow us to maintain parity and comparability with SRP. For our capital improvement program for $5.8 million, about $3 million associated with internal labor we anticipate to fund from revenue. That will allow us to reduce our bond debt service over a period of time. Total net income will be right at about $8.6 million. We'll maintain that $6 million transfer, and the ending fund balance will be about $12.5 million. Turning to the natural gas utility, if we could go to the Elmo, please. This is kind of the same type of diagram for the natural gas network as what we had for the electric network. It's a little less vertically integrated compared to most other energy industries. We have the production of natural gas typically in very remote locations from where gas is consumed. It goes through a series of processing plants, is compressed to very high pressures so it can be distributed over long distances. Most of our supplies come from the Texas Panhandle area or the Four Corners area, and we're also starting to get gas supplies through our various pipeline networks from Canada, parts of Mexico. We get some offshore gas through liquefied natural gas terminals in Baja, California, and different parts of Wyoming. So we have a very diverse mix of resources. We just recently had a pipeline come down through the I-17 corridor that provides us additional access to the Four Corners gas, which is where the lower supplies of gas come from. We were not able to work the economics such that it would justify going into a long-term transportation services with that pipeline company, so we're still primarily dependent upon El Paso natural gas. Here's a map of our service territory, and I'm going to let Mike Comstock, who's been a leader of our gas utility program for about 20 years, talk about our gas utility.
Thank you, Frank. You can see council or mayor council. You can see by the map that we touch all council districts in the city of Mesa. In the 1970s, there was a moratorium on natural gas growth. If you didn't have supply in your system, you couldn't grow the system without that supply. So that's why you see on this map there are areas that Southwest Gas serves inside the city of Mesa proper. But in general, our gas system serves about 56,000 customers, both in the city of Mesa as well as in the Magma service territory. We serve about 90 square miles of the Mesa city proper, and we have a certificated territory of about 236 miles in Pinal County to serve. Have about 1,088 miles of distribution lines, and we have four city gate stations to supply gas to our different areas of operation. During 2008, we had some major accomplishments in the gas system that we'd like to share with you. First of all, we completed a baseline assessment of our system to look at the integrity and operational status of that system. Happy to announce that Jacobs Consultancy, who performed that, gave us some very high marks in the outcome of that that study, and found that our system is very safe and operates very efficiently. Also in 2008, the Arizona Corporation Commission's Office of Pipeline Safety conducted their annual pipeline safety audit. It's an opportunity for the state regulators to come and look at our operation. They look at both the procedures that we follow and the paperwork that we develop, and they look for issues in terms of regulatory compliance. And I'm happy to report also that during 2008, we only had three issues that we identified in that audit, and we've had a chance to respond to those issues, and we've closed our audit successful and complete for the year. We had an opportunity to integrate shoe leather with technology in 2008. We literally walk a portion of our system looking for leaks each year, and that's a requirement of our regulation. And we were able to purchase in 2008 a machine that is calibrated to point a beam of light at known gas lines and then see the methane and send a signal back to us. Really good, and it's an opportunity for us to use that. Focused on damage prevention with our contractors, and also we worked with PHMSA and industry to develop some next generation natural gas pipe. Those were our accomplishments for the gas system.
Our 08-09 financial review looks pretty healthy. As you can see, we have a separation between what we call our PNCAF, which is our purchase natural gas cost adjustment factor mechanism, versus our non-gas supply cost. You can see it represents more than 50% of our total revenues, and the total amount was about $47.9 million budgeted for 08-09. Our actuals were about $4.4 million less than that. Most of that can be attributed to a decline in natural gas prices below what we had forecasted for 08-09. And the good thing about that is our PNCAF mechanism works. As you can see, our revenues were lower because of our costs were lower. And so the PNCAF mechanism works as designed. Our expenditures were about $4.7 million. And again, that was mostly attributable to our reduced natural gas supply costs. Our financial summary for 08-09, we budgeted a net income of about $6.8 million. We're going to be slightly north of there at 7.1. We had a general fund transfer budget of $6.7 million. The current plan is to transfer $8.4. That'll impact our ending fund balance by about $1.3 million from budget, but that's still at a healthy level. And through the forecast term, we think it's a healthy level of ending fund balance. It doesn't look like it's going to jeopardize any of our capital programs to maintain those key criteria of safety and reliability and good customer service. The 09-10 budget, we have a program 3% rate increase. We do have a very healthy CIP program in place for the next 5 years, and so the increase in rates is about $650,000. That will go to help fund the additional debt service associated with the bond sales to fund our capital improvement program. The revenues will be just shy of $45 million, and again, that reflects some reduced build consumption because of forecast of more normal weather, a little less heating degree days, if you will, during the wintertime, and associated declines in PNCAF because of we're seeing gas prices stay low compared to last year. I'm going to just kind of let you see the gas CIP slide so we can progress quickly. But we do have a very extensive master planning process on the gas side that we're looking to transform and implement on the electric side. We're using that as a tool. Our CIP budget for 09-10 is about $10.3 million. You can see a little over half of that is associated with replacements of aged gas lines that are in conjunction with the replacements of water lines and new construction, meaning extension of service to new customers, new developments is a little bit shy of $4 million. Our baseline allocations, the non-commodities piece is about $15.8 million. That's not much of an increase over 2009. Our commodities are right at about $21.5 million. So again, you can see that our energy supply costs are a substantial part of our total budget. Our key issues and summaries for our presentation and for our utilities is we have a large number of industry issues on the horizon. Some are very active in Congress and in the public policy debates, such as climate change. We've seen our energy markets, especially in terms of natural gas supply and costs, be very volatile. Last July, at the beginning of the month of July, natural gas prices were $12 per million BTU. By the end of the month, they were $5 per million BTU. In February, we paid less than $3 per million BTU, so a substantial piece of our gas. We're very enthusiastic and eagerly pursuing programs and efforts to fulfill the Council's strategic initiatives in the areas of sustainability and regional leadership, and we're really proud, and we're anxious to help and continue to contribute to the city's overall financial health by running efficiently, challenging conventional wisdoms, doing things in a new and different way, reorganizing as we have, and creating some real strategic opportunities and pursuing them. One of our major goals, Mayor and Council, as you suggested, what's that balancing act? Well, from my perspective, I want to maintain and improve the safety and reliability of our system while maintaining that parity with other local utilities. I think we've got a good plan to do that. We've got some other opportunities that we have historically haven't looked at, and I want to make sure we put those on the radar screen for our management and for you to consider as our board of directors.
Okay, great. Councilmember Finter.
Very quick question. I would love under Council Strategic Initiatives to someday have an in-depth conversation about MAGMA, how it operates. Is there a better way of doing that exchange with Southwest? There's so many issues there. So someday in the future when we have some time, I'd love to have that conversation.
We did a very thorough assessment of our operations at MAGMA going back, I think, about 2005. We can update that for you so you can see exactly how we're transitioning from where we have historically been to where we're moving towards, that being a very profitable enterprise for us. We have a geographically differentiated rate that we began implementation last year, where the customers in MAGMA pay a moderately higher rate than the customers in Mesa proper. So we've looked at that very closely. We're monitoring the situation, making sure that we don't overcharge those customers, but they clearly are not subsidized by Mesa's customers. So we're addressing that. And one other thing that I forgot to mention is acknowledging Vice Mayor Jones. He's been a very good advocate on behalf of the city and other publicly owned gas systems as a part of the American Public Gas Association's team that goes to Washington and advocates on our behalf. And I just want to make sure that we acknowledge, and the rest of the council and city management knows, just what an important role Kyle has played.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Anything else? Thank you. The next item on the agenda is to hear from the Parks, Recreation, and Commercial Facilities. While you're setting up, let's take about a 3 or 4 minute break. It's 8:47. Let's come back at 5:10.
The on-off's on the side. What needed to be put on? Because it was the main menu. Okay. That's what it was trying. Last one, they did this thing.
There's only one, so we'll have to do diving competitions or something. So back
whatever it is,
I took it. Gonna take that. I don't know if you saw that.
I'm
taking it out of the presentation.
So other than giving them, whatever we make, so you're probably we make 10 million, 9 million, or 1 million.
We'll see this when you're to buy or stand.
Right.
I'm
Well, I think we share that. It's just not really good. And I guess the idea is I want to discuss this. But we need to figure out the diagram. So I always from your perspective, on the 5 minutes, what is the problem I know?
It's about where you are in your system.
So the idea that I have a discussion about doesn't jeopardize
okay.
I think the council left.
I think Elvis has left the building. Mr. Evans.
Ready?
You have the floor, sir.
All right, good morning, Mayor and Council. As you are aware, the Parks, Recreation, Commercial Facilities Division reduced its budget this year by over $4.3 million. And going forward, in the next fiscal year, we will continue to reduce our operating budget to the tune of another $4.8 million. With these dramatic reductions in funding, as well as staff resources, it is imperative that we continue to find an innovative and distinguishing means to fulfill our mission while helping to build a better Mesa. This morning, I would like to provide an update and share with this council some of the initiatives we are implementing, along with some of the successes that we have been having. Thanks to a committed staff and a devoted citizen group that have stepped forward during these difficult economic times, we continue to move forward. The items that I want to cover today and highlight will be four areas. The first will be our parks, and talk a little bit about some of the things that we're doing with our playgrounds, as well as pool construction, our recreation program offerings, and then followed by our spring training season. First, Beverly Park and Park of the Canals. Our capital replacement budget was not immune to cuts. If our parks are to continue to remain a high priority, we must find ways to build, rebuild, and maintain our aging infrastructure. I think we have done that. As of late, we have entered into an agreement with an organization by the name of Kaboom. Kaboom is a national nonprofit organization housed out of Washington, D.C., who promotes outdoor play and has agreed to build two parks in Mesa. They received as of late a corporate sponsorship from the Home Depot Foundation, which will be the primary funding for these two parks. In addition to funding these projects, the Home Depot employees will be converging on these sites, the first on May 28th at the Park of the Canals near the road, the cross streets of Horn and Brown, and again on June 3rd at Beverly Park next to Main and Alma School, along with an army of neighborhood volunteers to build these parks. There will be some 400 volunteers at each one of these sites. Each project must be accompanied by a $10,000 cash contribution. That is the terms of the contract. Bert Millett, a resident of Mesa, has led the funding campaign for the Park of the Canals and has successfully reached their commitment for that particular park, the Park of the Canals. The funding recipient for the Beverly Park site, the West Mesa Community Development Corporation, have kicked off their campaign recently and are starting to receive donations, and are confident that they will be able to meet their funding needs as well. This is a conceptual schematic of what Beverly Park may look like. The Kaboom organization works closely with the neighborhood groups. They bring in children of all ages that live in the area to help design the park. They participate in the design charrettes of identifying what features will be in the play area. Not only does Kaboom and this Home Depot Foundation build the play features, but the sidewalks and the turf and the ramadas and the other amenities that will be in this park will all be part of that project as well. Both of these projects are examples of people coming together in an effort to build a better tomorrow. It is important to note that if we are to develop a model, which it's important to note that we are also developing a model in which these communities will continue to help maintain these parks after they are built. Now on to the status of our pool construction. The business model toward moving away from small, non-amenity pools to having fewer but larger multi-use facilities and amenity pools is well underway. We have the Carson Aquatic Facility leading the charge, and the Keno Regional Complex will shortly follow, hosting its grand opening on May 15th from 5 to 8 p.m. Our other pools to undergo this transformation will be the Rhodes Aquatics Complex, slated to open in September this year, followed by Skyline a year later. Skyline is currently 30% in design. We are scheduled to present in more detail our pool plan at a later date in May, but I thought I'd provide some visual updates of the progress that is being done to execute this new business model. This first picture illustrates Rhodes. It was taken in March and shows the zero depth entry and the concession stand in the far left-hand corner. This next slide illustrates the foundation of the flow rider, which is in the background there, as well as the dive tank and the competition pool, the 25-meter competition pool, where the construction workers are standing. This pool, this picture taken from the slide of Keno complex shows the buildings that are now constructed, as well as the bathhouses, the training facilities or the classrooms, and then the glass entryway there in the middle of the facility will be the main entrance to the facility from the parking lot. These next two pictures on the left is a view of the 50-meter competition pool and dive tank at the back end, and on the right, the tunnel slide and warm-up pool. This is a state-of-the-art facility, and uses and the use will be extremely the use of this pool will be extremely complex. We will start this summer at 5 o'clock in the morning and ending at 9 o'clock at night with our water polo practice. The contractor who built this particular pool was Shasta Commercial Contractors. They do pools nationwide. They have used this pool as their signature piece. It is one of the premier pools that they have ever constructed, and will be using this pool throughout the United States as a model going forward. And they've, as of yesterday afternoon, were down there taking promotional pictures for their brochures, which will be going out to all the contractors that build these types of facilities. Now moving on to summer recreation. As you know, we had to, again, make some adjustments to our program offerings. These budget reductions we took these initiatives through these budget reductions and consolidated our programs to house them particularly and primarily in our recreation centers. We have also, as we have began to program these things, are able to have a few sites, some school sites and some of our underserved areas. They certainly will not be to the multitude that we've offered in the past, but we will be able to do that. Some other things that we were able to do is to move from a four-day program to a five, which helps those parents that are working and need their children in some sort of program throughout the entire week. Our camps will also be offered, while limited, Monday through Friday. We will no longer be able to offer fee assistance. This will be the first year that we have not been able to do that. However, our program increases are still affordable and are consistent with other cities. Once again, we have been fortunate in this area to have some wonderful organizations step up and help us in these down times. I think you're aware of a recent project that transpired at the Broadway Recreational Center, where we had the Arizona Builders Alliance, along with a host of other individuals, step forward and contribute over $260,000 to that facility and materials, not to mention all of their volunteer time in retrofitting and doing a makeover to that facility. One other item of note, as we met with user groups and met with our participants of various programs and their parents, we announced some of the cuts. One in particular was in our adaptive program, as we had to cut kayaking for the disabled. Again, an example of how communities come together. At that very meeting, a parent stepped up and did not want, obviously, that program to be cut as it affects their quality of life of their children, and wrote out a check for the entire program. So as we go forward and we're educating the public of our needs, they are stepping forward, and we certainly appreciate all that they're doing to continue to build and help us run our programs. One of the things that we are doing as well is changing the way we do our registration. In an effort to reduce costs and to be more environmentally friendly, we are moving from a hard paper copy of our reservation and registration catalog, known as the timeout, to an online options, along with phone and in-person office visits. The public can now view our summer listings on our website, which is listed here. And important to note that that is currently live and on our website, because registration will begin as soon as April 17th for our aquatics programs and all of our summer recreation programs on the 24th. phone numbers there are listed as well for information of what programs will be offered and where. We used our adult sports as a pilot program to launch this online registration process. We believe it was extremely successful with over a 98% automated registration rate, meaning that those individuals that had a choice to do it through the various options chose to do it online. We believe a significant reason behind the success of the online registration of our leagues is that the participants are working individuals and find it difficult to make time to show up on the site and then stand in line to get into our leagues. With our online league scheduling, they can see all of the details in our offerings in advance. This online registration has eliminated the need to pay staff overtime or work weekends to sign up teams, and has eliminated the need for over 300 people to jump in their cars to come and register. Now for spring training, I'm sure you're familiar with the success that once again we had over at Hohokam Stadium. The Chicago Cubs once again broke the MLB season attendance record of now, which stands of 203,105. We held that record back in 2005 of 193,993. This season, you can see we added teams to the Cactus League. The Giants came in a second place out of in Scottsdale with 177,995 attendees, and the Dodgers came in a third place with 136,944. The last place team was the Rockies at 75,577 tickets sold. This represents approximately $3.7 million in ticket sales. We used our spring training as a way to increase revenue instead of decrease in other areas. We made a concerted effort to increase revenue there to improve our bottom line. This year, staff was innovative in adding seats. We increased the tent size out on the right field berm, as well as took some risers, some bleachers that we had at some of our pools that were being renovated, and added them to the patio areas. Thus, we were able to, when you flip the slide, to increase our game day attendance. This is an average which shows of the 19 games that we had over 10,690 individuals in our seats. However, we did have our highest attended game in league history against the Chicago White Sox, which totaled over 13,327 fans, which again is a single game day record, not only for Mesa, but for the league. When we look at who came in second, there is the Dodgers moved into second place, and simply because they had less games, their stadium was still being built at the beginning of the season. They had 15 games versus the Giants, who had 21 games, and the Cubs, who had 19. And once again, the Rockies came in last place with an average attendance of 4,722. We were a little nervous going into this season as it related to the economy and what people would spend. We increased ticket prices this year and thought that that would have an effect on our per capita spending as it relates to concessions, merchandise, and other novelty items inside the stadium. And we were pleasantly surprised that our concessions actually increased by $1.72 per head, going from $10.99 to $12.71. Our merchandise was slightly down by about 59 cents, but our total per capita spending per attendee was $18.83. We've not received the league averages, but we continue and believe that we will be one of the leaders as it relates to food and beverage and merchandise in the Valley. This pie chart represents the total tickets sold in the Cactus League, 1.5 million. What's interesting to note is if you take the Cubs, the Giants, Dodgers, Mariners, and D-backs, they almost represent half of the pie. So you have five teams there representing the majority or half of the tickets, total tickets sold in the Cactus League of the 14 teams. Lastly, I just want to conclude by saying that it's no doubt that we're living in difficult economic times. Cutting 57 staff was a rigorous task, not to mention cutting $7 million of ongoing operating dollars and $2 million of capital dollars out of our budget certainly created challenges. But I'm happy to report, Mayor and Council, that you have a staff and residents that live in this community that care about the community. They want to be partners with us, and they are. And I am confident that we will rise to the challenge and be successful even in this down economy. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions or hear any comments that you have regarding these budget implementations.
Great. Questions or comments? Councilmember Richens.
I just want to make a comment that how impressed I am with how much you guys have done with so little. I mean, you guys have been constantly the whipping boy of budget cuts, and you guys have been creative. You've forged great partnerships in the community that have also not only built a better Mesa, but have really accomplished a lot of new and innovative ways to bring service to the community. So you guys have done a lot with nothing. I just can't thank you enough for the great job you and your staff do. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you, Rhett. Really appreciate it.
You bet.
Thank you. Okay, the next item on the agenda here, a presentation discuss and provide direction on the city's participation in the National League of Cities Prescription Discount Drug Card Program.
Good morning, Mayor, members of the council. I'm Natalie Lewis. I'm an assistant to the city manager, and I'm here to present the National League of Cities Prescription Drug Discount Card Program. And I want to start off by thanking Councilmember Kavanaugh and Councilmember Summers for bringing this program to our attention, because it does seem like a really exciting thing. I'll try to be brief and just run through this real quickly to describe how this is going to work, respond to any questions that you have, but most importantly today, just make sure there's concurrence on the council that staff go ahead and move forward with this to implement it. So here's how it works. As a National League of City member, which the City of Mesa is, there is no direct fee for us to sponsor this program. Once we sign up, we're provided pre-printed Mesa-tailored credit card-sized cards that we then distribute to all of our residents as much as possible, get them out there in the community. We can also provide them to our employees or anybody who's interested in receiving them. Residents and employees then can take these cards to participating pharmacies in Mesa and receive up to a 20% discount on the retail cost of prescription medications, but only for medications that aren't already covered by insurance. And all major pharmacy chains across the United States participate in this, and many independent pharmacies also participate. In doing a little bit of upfront research, I discovered that there's 100 pharmacies in Mesa that are already signed up, have contracts, and are participating in this process. Cardholders pay nothing. There is no enrollment fee. There is no age restriction or income level requirements for them to participate. If they travel out of state, they can still use their City of Mesa card and go to one of those major pharmacies if they've got non-covered prescriptions that they've ordered and receive that discount. Some of the major pharmacies that are participating are Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, Osco, Costco, Safeway, Albertsons, Fry's, and Bash's. So all of those across our city are participating. And again, some of the independent agencies or pharmacies. Residents can also go online and see where there are participating pharmacies closest to them. The city's role in this is once we sign up and we do receive the cards, we'll receive probably about 45,000 of them up front. They tend to give you about 10% of your population. We can order as many as we want if we run out because we want to get these out there and distribute them. We're probably going to use our libraries and potentially a couple of our community centers so that we have some geographic distribution to get the word out and to distribute the cards that way. We can also distribute them here at City Hall for our employees who want to pick up a card. We're also going to work very closely with our human services staff so that we're specifically targeting our aging and lower income and Section 8 residents who this program might be very helpful to. We will also, I've talked to a couple of the other communities, there's 60 across the nation already who are participating in this, and many more who are coming online. But I talked to a few just to understand how it's been working for them, and really to understand, you know, the amount of work that it takes to get this going, and I feel really comfortable with all of the answers that we've received. But one of the lessons that they learned is that it does help for the city to do as much communication with the pharmacies as we can, just so that the service is seamless. They do have contracts in some cases, but we want to make sure they know we're now participating, we're getting the cards out, and that they should be alert and aware that they're going to be coming their way. So we'll do that and the best that we can in this regard. And the only other thing that we will be doing is just lots of advertising and using our existing mediums to do that through our utility bill and Mesa Channel 11 and news releases. And the CareMart that is sponsoring this provides us with boilerplate information, so it makes it real easy for us to tailor it to Mesa and get the information out. So from a fiscal perspective, we don't see a real direct impact at all. There'll be some minor printing and copying costs and some upfront staff coordination, but we feel we can accomplish all of this with existing resources. And with that, I'm here to answer any questions that you have, and again, just to make sure there's concurrence from council that we move forward with it.
Okay. Vice Mayor Jones.
As we were discussing this with representatives back at NLC, the key factors are, one, the pharmacies are the ones footing the bill for the program.
Absolutely.
NLC is coordinating it. Participating cities receive the cards, and their responsibility is just to get them distributed.
Mm-hmm.
And people understand that it is to cover costs that are not covered by insurance.
Exactly.
Gives them a discount card to use for pharmacy that is not covered by insurance, and that's as simple as it can be.
It is as simple as it can be, and the pharmacies are participating in this because it's a marketing effort for them. They're trying to, you know, provide a program during very tough economic times for people, create some goodwill out there, and hopefully create long-term customers, and so it's worth it to them to participate and to take on those costs.
Councilmember Summers.
Did you mention that one of the benefits, too, is that some pet medications are also covered, if they're also used for human conditions?
Yes, and I'm looking into that a little bit more, but I do understand that if you have pet medications and you take it to a participating pharmacy, and if that pet medication is also used for human conditions, then that also can be covered and you can receive some of the discounts.
Mm-hmm. And a couple of things we might also do for advertising, we might consider just putting a simple website up with a list of the participating.
That's exactly what we're doing, yes.
And the Fire Department Connector program has been fantastic, mm-hmm. providing social services, extending social services out for fire and police services, and they should probably get a big stack of them as well.
Great idea.
Councilmember Richens.
I think you said it, but I probably missed it. Who provides the actual physical card and prints those? And
CareMart is working in partnership with the National League of Cities, and they will be the one to print the cards and provide them directly to us.
Okay, and so then they provide them to us, and we distribute them? And
right. We actually provide them our logo. They print them and send them to us.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Okay. Anything else? Natalie, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate that.
Direction is move forward?
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. What I'm hearing is direction is to move forward with this, since there's basically no real cost or significant cost to City of Mesa. It's a great benefit for our residents if used properly, especially for those pet drugs with human conditions.
Pets with human conditions.
Pets with human conditions.
Like arthritis, for example.
No, it's a great program. I remember the first time I heard it in the National League, and I've talked to other cities, mayors who have used it, and they've said what a great program it is for their citizens.
Thank
so
you.
I appreciate you following up on that.
We'll get the cards in about 3 weeks, so hopefully we'll get them out on the streets within four, and people can start saving money. And we will keep you posted as we learn more and how many cards get distributed and how much money is getting saved out there.
Great.
I'm sorry. One last question. There's no, you know, this is a question people not often ask, but is there a tracking mechanism? So if I use that card, does some corporation know that I'm getting X for whatever reason?
For the pharmacies that do have a contract through Caremart, and when they do provide that discount, it does go back to Caremart, and they do track it. And on a monthly basis, they provide those numbers to the NLC, and the NLC provides them to the community. So we will definitely have those numbers on a monthly basis.
But we know how many, but we don't know what specific medication someone's getting.
You know, I don't know that answer, but I'll find out for you.
Well, we don't know that Mrs. Jones got this this prescription on this date at this spot. We do not get that information. It's privacy protected and everything.
We don't want to know. But the question is that related to, like, your, if someone was pulling insurance records to see if you've taken something in the last 20 years, would that be part of something they pull?
I don't know, but I can,
like,
follow up.
Your normal medical insurance, if you put something through on your insurance card, there's a record of, you know, where you went, what you got, those type of things.
Well, the pharmacy has to record everything.
I'll find out more about what it is that they're tracking for you.
Great. Thank you.
And all that's protected by, especially in medical issues, privacy.
Right. Privacy issues.
Yeah, the HIPAA. Yeah, so it wouldn't be available anyway.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Hear reports on meetings or conferences attended? Any reports? Okay. Vice Mayor.
Since we're going to go to meetings, then, I just need to have a reminder that this Saturday, April 11th, at Station 201, 360's First Street, a pancake breakfast from 8 to 10. And as part of that pancake breakfast, we're also having a food drive, which has been going on throughout the city, and appreciate your participation in that.
Great. Thank you. Great segue to Mr. Brady on other meetings and schedules.
Thank you. And we've mentioned the pancake breakfast. The next study session we will not have a study session on April 16th due to the fact that the East Valley Partnership and East Valley Chambers are hosting the Congressman Mitchell and Congressman Flake breakfast. So I think you all have been invited to that. We do have a household hazardous waste collection event on April 18th from 8 a.m. to noon. And this one will be at the Center Street facility, which is 2412 North Center. And our next council meeting will be April 20th. And we do plan on having a fairly extensive study session prior to that council meeting. So we'll look for an early start time for Monday, April 20th. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Brady. We have one request to speak as a pre-scheduled public opinion appearance, Mr. Ed Arroyo. Mr. Arroyo, thank you so very much for being patient. Appreciate it.
Thank you for hearing me.
If you'd like to just sit down, and you've got 3 minutes, so thank you.
Mr. Mayor, thank you very much. Council members, good morning. The only thing that I have here, I'm area manager for Hertz Rent-A-Car here in Phoenix Southeast area. And there are on the table, there's a proposed airport fee for Falcon Field, which is important to us. It concerns us greatly, as we've gone through this before in other cities. As I understand the proposal and as it is written, any rental transactions that are going to be transacted out of Falcon Field are going to be assessed a 10% transaction fee. Right now it includes any companies that are both on airport and off airport. So when we are considering our competition, it's a fair and balanced thing. If they pick up customers from the airport and they are off airport, they are paying the 10% fee. If they're delivering cars onto airport, they're also paying the fee, which we are paying as being on airport. However, the one thing that wasn't considered is that upwards of 80% of all our transactions are non-airport generated. We deal greatly in what's called the insurance replacement market and replacement market in general, which is our own citizens who are having their cars repaired either in body shops or mechanical shops. Upwards of 80%, as I said, of our business at Falcon Field is this type of transaction. Now, what that means to us is that as frugal as our customers are right now, an added 10% fee is going to drive our customers across the street right across McKellips Drive to our two competitors where they don't have to pay that 10% fee. 80% of our business, in the past this has happened, so I know it's fact that we will lose a substantial amount of business. That means that we will not be in the position to continue to operate on airport or off airport. That's the concern here. It no longer, the playing field is no longer level. So I'm asking.
Mr. Royal, just to explain so everyone understands, sure. you have a desk inside the fixed base operator there, the
yes, we do.
Executive. Mm-hmm. And you park your cars there, and but this is not, from what I'm hearing from you, this is not a normal, like when you go to Sky Harbor and you cater to those people who are flying in and parking their planes at Falcon Executive or elsewhere on the airport and coming in. That's about 20% of your business, what I'm hearing.
It's a little less than 20% of our business, about 17.
So even though you're physically inside, what would, I guess the FBO is sort of a terminal, but it's not the same as the terminal at Sky Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
You're physically located there, and you're there because there is a demand. However, what keeps you there, if what I'm hearing from you, what keeps you there is the off-airport business that comes in and simply uses your location.
Exactly.
And whereas the guy across the street may not get anyone flying in to Falcon, or not a whole lot, that puts you, since 80% of your business is the same customer pool as your competitor across the street, that's what you're saying.
Exactly.
Let me ask you this. How important do you think it is to have your location and to provide that service on a Falcon to even cover just that less than 20% that you get there?
As our corporate mandates are, anytime there is a fixed base operator or an airport situation, Hertz wants to be on site.
Yeah.
Okay, but as far as being important to it, the options that would be open to us would be to move off airport, in which case the city or the airport would be losing that concession fee from the pilots that we're dealing with. They'd be losing the, well, it would be an increased cost to open up off airport, one that is fairly substantial. The other option is to close operations entirely in that area. That's what we're faced with if this fee goes through as written. So my question would be, is there any possibility
of... Can we
sit
down with Mr. Arroyo? Because maybe there's a way to distinguish
between
off-airport right. and on-airport.
And I want to set the stage as to how important... You know, as a pilot who flies around to a lot of different airports, I can tell you that the existence of a rental car operation at an FBO is extremely important and factors into the decision as to whether you're going to fly to that airport or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you that, for example, if I go into the L.A. Basin, I will go to one airport that has a rental car and skip an airport that doesn't, simply because, well, it doesn't do a whole lot of good to find an airport if you can't drive off of it. And I don't want to wait for someone to come from clear off an airport location to pick me up. So I'm trying to understand that, yes, you could locate across the street, but we also have a situation here with Falcon having that operation there is important to us too.
Well, we would very much like to stay. Okay. My question is it possible to separate that out?
I think if we can figure out how to separate out that part of the business, we can have that conversation. So
and this has been a proposal. We haven't acted on it, so your timing is good. We're going to have a separate hearing in that, which talks specifically about these rates and goes approval. So what we're doing now, this is information purpose today. I think Mr. Brady and a member of his staff will get together with you and look at ways that perhaps we can accommodate fees and pricing and however we can do it, so that when we come up to the final action by the council.
Well, yeah, maybe for his specific case, we can be explicit about the separation between the two different.
Yeah, we'll figure out something so that, but once again, we haven't acted formally on that. That is coming up, so this is good information to have.
Thank you very much. I appreciate
your
time.
Thank you, Mr. Royal. Okay. Ms. Crocker, do we have any other requests to speak from citizens present?
No requests, Mayor.
Okay. If there are no other items.
No. Mayor, we have.
Executive session.
Thank you.
No.
We'll finish with this portion of the meeting, and I'll entertain a motion to move into executive session.
So moved.
I have a motion from the Vice Mayor, a second by Councilmember Summers. Just a given.
Okay.
All in favor say aye. 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 We are now moving into executive session.